I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. For centuries, we humans have been waging a war against microbes, seeing them as agents of disease and illness. These are the bacteria, the viruses, archaea, and fungus that live in and all around us. But now that view is changing, and we're beginning to understand that microbes play a critical role in our lives and in the lives of all species on Earth. Scientists are discovering that our microbiomes, these are the communities of microbes that call our skin or our gut or mouth home, affect everything. And that includes our immune system, our sense of taste, our mood, weight gain, and much, much more. Science writer Ed Yong has written a new book about this hidden world, and it's called I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. Yong also writes for The Atlantic. He spoke to Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder.
I want to begin with something you say in the book, that we are a zoo in our own right. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you mean about this zoo. What does it look like?
So if you zoomed in on our skins or in our mouths or anywhere on our body, we would see large communities of bacteria and other microbes. They surround us and they fill us. All told, the average person contains some, say, 37 trillion of these microbial cells, which is roughly one for each of our own actual human ones. So each of us is this massive community of thousands of other species, and they're not just hitchhikers, they're not just stowaways. They profoundly influence our lives. They help to digest our food and calibrate our immune system and sculpt our organs. And the same is true not just for humans, but for the entire animal kingdom. So every form of life that we're familiar with, everything we can see, every elephant and ant, every hummingbird and hawk and hornet is really a community of many, many microscopic living things.
And you talk about them almost as different ecosystems on us, whether in our gut, on our skin, in our mouths, these very different communities.
That's right. So each of our body parts has its own particular community of microbes living on it. So our forearms are dry like deserts. The inside of my nose is moist like a rainforest. And these conditions affect the different species that live there. And that changes the way they interact with our lives. So we are walking zoos. We have all these different zones and habitats on us. We are thriving with life. And of course, one of the things that I try to stress in the book is that this is a good thing. We see bacteria and other microbes as dangers, as signs of dirt and disease. But in fact, that is far from the case. Very few species actually cause us illness. The vast majority are benign or even beneficial. They are crucial parts of our lives, and it is time to appreciate their role in our existence and our nature as vast colonies and collectives.
And they've existed for a very long time on Earth, hundreds of millions of years. You have a really nice way of thinking about time and the age of the Earth as a calendar year. Can you lay that out?
Yeah, if you pretend that the entire history of the planet fits into a single calendar year, so the Earth was created on January 1st, and it's now near the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve. Well, humans evolved around half an hour ago, so we are just a footnote on life's history. Bacteria have been around since, say, early March. And then multicellular life, so animals and plants and all the things we can see and that we're familiar with, turned up very late again, so probably October or so. So the vast majority of life on Earth was entirely dominated by microbes, and this is their planet. They are the rulers of the world. They run the show. And we appeared late. And when we animals evolved, we did so in this microbial world. We plugged ourselves into their biology, and we came to live with them, be influenced by them, and depend on them. And they shaped our evolution and our fates in truly wondrous ways.
Well, I want to talk a minute about some of the history because, you know, microbes have been around for millions of years, shaping the planet, shaping us. But it wasn't until the 1600s that we actually saw them. Can you tell me about this sort of amazing discovery?
Right. I think this is one of the most important moments in biology. So in 1675, a Dutch man called Antony van Leeuwenhoek, who was not a trained scientist, he was not a scholar, he was just an amateur, he saw microbes for the first time. And he did that with two crucial things. He had the world's best microscopes, which he created himself, grinding these impossibly perfect lenses. And then he also had insatiable curiosity. Mm-hmm. So he was really fascinated by the world around him, and he trained his lenses on everything. And when he looked in various sources of water from lakes or pots near his house, he saw this world of tiny living things moving about, going about their existence beyond the threshold of our perception. And that's astonishing to me. You know, he was the first person to become aware of this hidden world, to understand that microbes existed.
Yeah, I wonder what that moment must have been like.
Right. It's so hard to imagine. He's the first person in the world to see these things. And I think really importantly, he was not disgusted by them. He saw massive communities of bacteria in his own mouth by scraping off bits of dental plaque from around his teeth. And he was excited. He was thrilled to learn that his body was host to these communities of organisms. And I think that's something that we've lost because we've come to associate them with disease. And I think it's something that we're returning to, understanding that the microbiome is a really important and valuable part of our lives, something to appreciate and cherish.
And it wasn't that long after his discovery that the connection between microbes and disease really dominated our thinking about them.
Yeah, that's right. We started thinking about them as germs. We tried to assault them with antibiotics. We emphasized cleanliness and sanitation over all else. And I think, you know, one has to note that these measures were very important. So antibiotics are one of the greatest public health goods that there has ever been. But I think we're starting to appreciate now that just blindly and broadly annihilating microbes in our environment and in our own bodies is not necessarily a good thing. Sure, we need to be careful about hygiene and we need to avoid diseases, but we also need to take care to avoid collateral damage to the communities of microbes that we depend upon.
Well, let's talk about some of the beneficial roles, some of these partnerships that you talk about between mm-hmm. microbes and their hosts. You have amazing examples throughout your book. What are some of your favorite examples?
So if we look to the broader animal kingdom, there are sap-sucking bugs like aphids and cicadas that have bacteria in their cells that act as dietary supplements. Those microbes produce nutrients that are missing from the insects' meals of plant sap. And without those microbes, those insects would not be able to survive. They wouldn't be able to exploit that vast treasure trove of nutritional riches in the plants around them. And they, because they could tap into that food source that no other animal can exclusively tap, they became inordinately successful. There are something like 85,000 species of them. And then if you look into the deep ocean, there are types of worms and clams that live in deep sea vents that take that to an extreme. They rely on their microbes for all their nutrition, so much so that they have lost their mouths and their guts. These creatures don't eat, because why would you want to eat when you could have microbes to provide you with all the sustenance that you need?
Yeah, it's amazing. Microbes have really allowed some animals to thrive in really inhospitable environments.
Right. They can colonize areas that would have been inaccessible to them. They can eat things that they wouldn't have been able to digest or that would be poisonous. So many animals, from koalas to some rats to beetles, rely on microbes to break down the poisons in the plants that they eat. And others, familiar ones, cows, sheep, deer, they rely on microbes to digest the complex carbohydrates in their plants. And something like a cow gets something like 70% of its energy through microbial metabolism. Again, if bacteria disappeared, these animals would die. And it's because they formed partnerships with microbes that they have been so successful. You know, think about Africa. Think about those vast herds of antelope and wildebeest and zebra. That would be completely empty if there weren't microbes around to help these creatures with the simple act of digestion.
Well, there are a number of these sort of alliances, these partnerships. But you also, you know, write about some where it really feels like the microbe is pulling the strings, changing the animal's sex, deciding who it will mate with. So it's a little more than a partnership, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think I'm very keen to clarify that there is no such thing as a good microbe or a bad microbe. Sure, we shouldn't treat them all as germs and things that are going to kill us, but we shouldn't pretend that they are our friends either. Our relationships with them are often quite tenuous. They require constant work in order to keep them harmonious. And there are some microbes which can play lots of different roles. So one of the ones I talk in my book, which is one of my favorites because its biology is so incredible, is called Wolbachia. Mm-hmm. And some types of Wolbachia are sexual parasites, like you say. They are inherited from mothers to daughters, but they don't pass down the male line. So males are a dead end to it. And they get rid of males. Sometimes they kill them outright. Sometimes they transform the males into females. Sometimes they allow animals to reproduce asexually so that they don't need to, the females can just clone themselves and don't need males at all. But Wolbachia can also be beneficial. It can act as one of those dietary supplements I told you about. And crucially, it's beneficial to us because if you put Wolbachia in some species of mosquito, you stop those mosquitoes from being able to transmit viruses and parasites that cause diseases like dengue fever, Zika, mm-hmm. Possibly malaria, chikungunya. Suddenly these insects turn from vectors into dead ends for disease. And some scientists are now trying to put Wolbachia into mosquitoes and then release these insects into the wild to stop the spread of really terrible tropical diseases like dengue, like Zika. And the crucial thing there is Wolbachia is so good at manipulating animals, so good at making itself a core part of its hosts, that it spreads like wildfire. So if you release mosquitoes, a small population of mosquitoes that carry this bacterium into the wild, within months, all the mosquitoes in the local population, or the vast majority of them, should also carry Wolbachia and therefore be unable to spread human diseases, which sounds like a massive win in my book.
Yeah. So it's the good and bad, this Wolbachia. I guess you're not the only one. That bacteria is particularly a favorite of a lot of people because there's a conference, I guess, where people get together to talk about Wolbachia and research, right?
Right. Yeah, there's like a biannual Wolbachia-specific conference. It's wonderful. And the thing I love most about this is that this bacterium was discovered in 1924 by two scientists who thought nothing of it. No one realized that it was important. And then only about like 50 years later did many other scientists realize that it's actually everywhere. It's in something like 40% of species of insects and other arthropods. So it's enormously successful. And then only later did we learn what it's capable of in terms of manipulation and then how we could harness it to save human lives. And I think that just shows how important it is to explore the natural world and to understand which microbes are there, what they do in animal bodies, because sometimes the benefits that we can reap for that are enormous, but also unpredictable.
And that's Ed Young speaking with Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder about microbes. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY. Let's get back to producer Debbie Bilder's interview with science writer Ed Young about his new book. It's called I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life.
Well, let's turn to the relationship we have with the microbes. You mentioned some of the things that they do for us. Go over again what our basic microbiome does.
So they help to sculpt our bodies and keep our bodies ticking over. And you can see this by looking at animals that lack microbes altogether. So sterile mice and fish and other laboratory animals that sort of act as a mirror for our own bodies. And you see that without microbes, so much of their biology is just askew, like their bones and their blood vessels, their gut, their immune system. None of these develop fully and properly. And that suggests that, you know, we rely on microbial signals to grow, to unfold from a single egg into a fully functioning adult. We rely on them to help to digest our food, to seal up the lining of the gut so that stuff doesn't pass into our bloodstream. We rely on them, surprisingly, to coordinate and calibrate our immune system, which is really weird, right? Because you think of the immune system as a thing that keeps microbes at bay, that detects them and kills them. But in fact, what we see is that microbes help to construct and attune various components of our immune system to get this balance between inflammatory responses that will keep infections, that will bring infections at heel, versus anti-inflammatory responses that stop us from overreacting to like allergens and pollen and the microbes that live within us. So far from just being the targets of a very militaristic defensive immune system, it's more like the microbes are the residents of a national park, and the immune system is a team of rangers that are keeping them in check, but not trying to destroy them. They're keeping the populations under control, chucking out invasive species, and just looking after that large community.
But a lot of the focus now has been looking at when that community gets thrown off balance and when things get out of whack. And scientists are linking this to, as you were mentioning, inflammatory diseases, things like obesity and autism, asthma and diabetes. Tell me a little bit about that link and what some of the research is showing us.
So many of these studies compare people with a disorder or an illness against healthy people. They look at their microbes and then look at differences in their microbiomes. And they almost always find some. So many diseases, this huge laundry list of conditions have been linked to changes in the microbiome. What's less clear in most of these cases is whether those changes cause the problems or are a consequence of them or whether something else is going on. These are questions that scientists are still starting to pick apart. But it does seem that many of these conditions have a microbial component to them. They're related to not just like one infectious bacterium causing a disease, which that model that we're very familiar with, but instead an entire community shifting into a disease state, something that scientists call dysbiosis.
And there are a number of things or a number of causes that scientists are looking at that are, I guess, behind that shift. Things like antibiotics, our hyper-clean environments, our diet.
Yeah, there are a lot of people working on understanding what changes the microbiome, what disrupts it. So obvious candidates are antibiotics. Obviously, these are drugs that kill bacteria, but also the focus on sanitation, the fact that we have antibacterial everything.
Clothing.
I mean,
the list goes on and on.
Absolutely. You know, I was at a hotel reporting for this book, and I picked up the phone, and it said antibacterial handset.
That one I had not seen.
Right. Yeah. So there's that. There are changes in our diet. You know, we're eating less fiber. Fiber contains a wide variety of different carbohydrates, which nourish a wide diversity of microbes in our gut, each of which is specializing on one of these particular foodstuffs. So changes in our diet. Perhaps changes like C-sections or a fall in breastfeeding. I mean, the thing is that a lot of these connections are still being studied, and there's a lot of evidence that microbiomes are resilient to change. You know, these are ecosystems like rainforests or grasslands. You ding them, they'll bounce back. So the question then becomes, how much disruption do you need in order to permanently change the course of your microbiome, to shift it into a disease state? Does that need to happen when you're a kid, when you're a baby? You know, it seems like that's a more vulnerable time in your life. Do these things affect us in combination? Could you be all right if you eat a poor diet, but if you eat a poor diet and you take lots of antibiotics over a long period of time and you're, you know, sanitizing everything to an extreme, then do you get problems? I think these are the things that the scientists in the field are currently trying to tease apart.
Well, I want to raise one more point about our clean environments, because I was recently reading a piece about the importance of farms and treating kids with asthma. It's mm-hmm. not just our antibacterial products that we use. It's also we sort of aren't, you know, playing in dirt anymore, and we're not close to animals,
right,
and we're not out on the farm, and we've sort of lost touch with, I guess, the dirt. Is that fair to say?
We have isolated ourselves from the world around us, and we've created spaces where we've tried to remove as many bacteria as possible. And now it seems like that might not be a good thing. You know, I have a scientist friend who features in the book who actually bought a dog because studies have shown that homes with dogs have a vastly greater diversity of bacteria in them than homes without, which tend to be these microbial deserts. And he wanted his kids exposed to a wide range of microbes from an early age to calibrate their immune systems, to affect their development. And other people are looking in the microbiomes of buildings, of the built environment. Like, are we, in clearing away microbes that would naturally be there, have we created vacancies that more dangerous species, those that cause disease, can occupy? Is that why there are so many hospital-acquired infections going on? So I think by understanding these hidden worlds and the way we are changing them, we can get hints about how we might actually control them and make them better. Maybe in the future we will deliberately add microbes to our environment, whether by getting a dog or by actually applying them. Maybe we will have probiotics for buildings. Who knows?
Dogs for buildings. That's good news about the dogs, because I have a couple mangy guys at my house. So I'm talking with science writer Ed Yong. He is the author of a great new book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. And we're talking about the important role microbes play in our lives and in our health. I want to talk, you mentioned this a little earlier, but about how we develop our microbiomes, how we pick up the microbes. We come from a sterile environment in the womb, and I guess we pick up our bacteria first when we go through the birth canal.
That's right. It's our mum's first present to us, a zeroth birthday present of her microbes. The fascinating thing to me is that if you look at, say, a large landscape like a new island or a forest that's recovering from fire, you can see like predictable waves of species. So you'll get lichens and then shrubs and then trees. You can see the same thing in a baby. You get these waves of microbes. One species will rise to the fore and then fade away. Another will take its place. Same predictable fashion. It just shows you that we are all ecosystems that work along very similar lines. And to me, one of the most amazing ways and unexpected ways in which mothers can influence that world is through breastfeeding. We think of breast milk as a way of nourishing infants, but about 10% of that milk consists of these sugars that babies cannot digest. And they are there as food for microbes. They specifically nourish certain strains and species that have co-evolved with us and have the ability to very efficiently digest these sugars. And in return, those microbes feed the baby's gut cells, they seal the lining of its gut, they tamp down inflammation. So a breastfeeding mother, to me, is not just someone looking after her kid. She is also an ecosystem engineer. She is building an entire world inside her baby, ensuring that the right species colonize the infant and the wrong ones are kept at bay. And that's, you know, part of this grander view of life that I want to convey in the book, just how incredible something as familiar as breastfeeding can be when you look at it through this microbial lens.
Well, as we begin to understand the role our microbiome plays on our health, we've quickly come up ways to manipulate it, to tweak it, to try to use it to improve our health. And you write a lot about, for example, fecal transplants that have been very successful. Tell me about some of the research that is jumping off of sort of what we're learning about microbes and a healthy microbiome.
So you mentioned fecal transplants, and these are some of the most effective microbiome-based treatments around. They, not for everything, but they seem to be incredibly good for treating infections by C. difficile, Clostridium difficile, a very weedy bacterium that causes really nasty, sometimes fatal cases of diarrhea. And one way of treating them is to take the stool from a healthy donor and to put them in the gut of someone with this infection. It sounds very unorthodox, certainly gross, but it works. It works. In clinical trials, it is far more effective than standard antibiotics. And it has been used in hundreds, probably thousands of cases with incredible results. Now, scientists have tried fecal transplants for a number of other conditions, from inflammatory bowel disease to metabolic disorders like diabetes, and the results there have been more inconsistent. So I think it's still tough to reset a person's microbiome. You know, doing this is like re-turfing a lawn that's been overrun with dandelions. You're trying to, you know, get rid of weeds and establish a healthy population. That might be easy in the case of C. difficile, but it seems to be much harder in a lot of other microbiome related conditions.
Well, I also wonder how wise it is. I mean, microbes, bacteria can evolve really quickly. They can swap DNA. It doesn't take, you know, hundreds of years, millions of years to evolve. They're very quick at this. I mean, are we sort of playing with something that could have results that we don't expect? I mean, you talk about going from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde, a bacteria or a virus.
I mean, I think this is a really good point. If we look at this ecologically, we humans have got a pretty bad track record of introducing species into places where they don't belong, you know, in with good intentions, but then with unintended consequences. And I think if we treat our bodies in the same way, it pays to be cautious. And I think there's a lot of good science out there trying to work out what is actually going on with the microbiome? Which bacteria are in my body versus those in yours? And then how do they compete and cooperate? How might we be able to introduce beneficial species and get them to take hold in a way that isn't going to do us harm in the long run? And I think maybe the biggest gains will be quite small scale ones in the short term. For example, we see that the effectiveness of various drugs, everything from cancer immunotherapies to paracetamol, varies depending on the composition of our microbiome. So maybe one immediate use is for prognostics, so to try and work out who is going to benefit most from a medication and who would not.
Of course, before science has really figured this out, consumers are already jumping in on this, and
right,
companies are producing probiotic foods and people are gobbling them up. What do we know about how effective, you know, probiotic drinks are, yogurts? I mean, are we better to just pet a dog or play in the dirt?
I mean, it's such a huge industry, right? And I think what people don't realize is that to a large extent, probiotics just wash through you. They're like a breeze that blows between two open windows. They may rattle a few things along the way, but you know, they're in and they're out. But the idea of probiotics, the concept of them, is, I think, sound. Like, the idea that you might want to manipulate the microbiome by adding beneficial bacteria is a solid one. I think we just need to be much savvier about it, and we don't really have the understanding yet to be able to come up with these cocktails, predict what they're going to do, and to actually have them take hold and have significant health benefits. You know, they seem to be good for things like infectious diarrhea, a couple of other conditions, but by and large they are underwhelming, especially when contrast to the you know, the many grandiose health claims that surround them.
We've been talking about the microbiome on an individual, but there are home microbiomes, that each of our house has a unique microbiome.
Yeah, so at the end of my book, I talk about this connection between the microbiomes inside us and in the external environment. I wanted to show that understanding microbes really connects us to the world at large. Like, I am sitting here in the studio, bleeding microbes into space. With apologies to the next guest, I'm coating the world around me with an imprint of this microbial side of myself, and equally I'm taking in microbes from the world around me. So this is constant to and fro traffic, which means that our choices, how we design our buildings and our public spaces, affects the microbiome that we could potentially pick up. That has relevance for our homes, for our hospitals, for everything really. Maybe in the future, rather than trying to destroy all the bacteria in the world around us, we might actually want to add those that either have benefits or that crowd out the ones that could potentially cause disease. Maybe in addition to the probiotic idea for people, we might even have probiotics for buildings.
As I was reading your book, I was continually struck by, you know, how incredible these microbes are, how powerful they are, how adaptive they are. And I kept thinking, you know, who's pulling the strings here? Mm-hmm. Who's controlling who?
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about because I think, you know, we think we're kind of a big deal, right? We like to think that we are in control of our own fates, of our own lives. But I just want to point out that microbes have been around for billions of years, longer than we have. They have the run of the earth, and they have so many influences on our lives. So, you know, if you think about a microbe in my gut, it's got a nice, happy lifestyle. I feed it with food all the time. You know, it has everything it could possibly need. But if it releases a chemical that, say, makes me hungrier and I eat more food, then it has more food. So it's in its interest to do that. And it's interesting to think about the ways in which our microbiome might actually be affecting us, influencing our behavior. Mm-hmm. There are some signs of this. It's still being looked at. But I think it's worth remembering that we are together in this, but we are also separate entities with our own evolutionary interests. So I think a lot of microbiome science is really about maintaining these relationships, keeping them peaceful. It is a partnership, yes, but it is often an uneasy one that takes work to maintain.
This has been fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Ed Young is a science writer. His new book is I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life.
You'll be hearing more from Debbie Bilder with more interviews on Radio Times. Coming up next, Radio Times producer Liz Fiedler will introduce us to an unusual construction company here in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Marty Moscoen. Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler sat down recently with Javier Garcia Hernandez, one of the owners of a Philadelphia construction company called Mexcon. Liz saw banners for the company's business in her South Philadelphia neighborhood and decided to talk with Hernandez about his construction cooperative and the lives of the company's many employees who are undocumented immigrants from Mexico.
Javier, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having us over.
First, let's start with the name. Tell me about the name Mexcon, M-E-X-C-O-N. And on the banners, it looks like your logo is the masked face of a Mexican wrestler.
We purposely did that because the mask sort of represents the hidden identity. To us or to me, we saw them as a worker wrestling in the ring. Wrestling, lucha libre in Mexico, is a big theme. It's something we grew up with. When we were putting the name together, realized that would be a good fit because we identify with the luchador as being a worker out in the field doing demolition, doing framing, whatever the work may be. We think of ourselves as wrestling in the workspace.
Oh, so as construction workers, you feel like you're
wrestling. It's rough. Construction, the work we do is rough. So it's sort of we saw it as a good fit. It's a hidden identity of immigrants. We feel like we have this identity, and that's what the mask sort of to us represents us.
Tell me who works for Mexcon and where the name came from.
So it came Mexicans in construction, that was the idea. When we started, a few of us were all Mexicans, and we decided we wanted to work for ourselves, and that was the idea of starting our own company. As time goes on, we've been taking bigger projects and more projects. So it's very exciting to see the way we have developed. My friend and I, we started on it with a bicycle. We rode a bicycle carrying our tools.
You started the business 3 years ago with a bicycle?
We started on the bicycle. We carry a ladder on the bicycle, and my co-worker Santiago would put a bag of cement on his shoulder. And now we have six trucks, and we've been growing, buying equipment, and growing into a general construction company.
And before this, you mentioned that you guys were talking and wanted to work for yourselves. Before this, were you working for different contractors?
Correct. And that was the idea of creating a different sort of a work model, and that's the idea of the co-op. We're not a formal co-op yet, but the idea, the seed is there. We have to water the seed and develop this idea or principle that we would like to work on.
I've heard a lot of different co-ops, but I've never heard of a construction company operating as a co-op. Tell me why that appeals to you, why that appeals to the other employees, and kind of how it would work. What would be the benefit?
So the one thing to clarify, they're not my workers. That's one of the biggest. We work together, so we're co-workers. We work together. We have fun working together. I left the job that I was involved with working with many of them, and we were not only exploited, but the people we had been working for, most of them, we felt that they were not being included in the company or the people they work for. So the idea was, why work for somebody who doesn't care about us? We can work for ourselves. We can start working together. And we've been very fortunate. We have so much work, and it's working out up to this point.
Can you talk about legal status, and as much as you feel comfortable, talk about the legal status of the men who work with you and why that's an important thing to understand?
Immigration status has been perhaps one of our biggest barriers as to why we haven't been able to feel comfortable and say, let's do this together, let's put our resources together and create a co-op. The company, I'm the only one with the legal status, and so I don't carry the same burdens or the same struggles as they do. I feel more empowered. If we have an issue, I can call the police. If they have an issue, if they hesitate asking for help because of the legal status. That's been a big barrier for the company are operating. We have a number of trucks, and all of us don't have a driver license, only a couple of us. So they can't really drive, and to get to their jobs, we need drive. So that's another big issue, driver's license, the lack of papers, health insurance, and there's a whole number of issues that are sort of associated together.
And those challenges, like lack of driver's license, could be specifically difficult, I would imagine, for a construction company. Your business is moving things from one job to another. Mm-hmm. So
we drive around every day to get to the jobs.
So Mexicon is composed of you and about 20 other
20
men.
Others, but only about 10 of us are sort of the core of the company. As I said, we don't operate as a formal co-op because we don't have a legal document that states this is how we're going to disperse the funds. About 10 of us, we share the burden of the cost of operating or the profits. There have been that much profits, but they sometimes we struggle as we move on, as we move through the jobs. And about 10 of us, we sort of, all right, we didn't get paid this week, but we'll get covered next week.
So as I understand it, you are the only member of Mexicon, which includes maybe more than 20 people, who is here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. legally. And I just want to go back to that just for a minute. I know there are more things to talk about. Yeah. I do want to go back to that because it's something you and I talked about extensively before this interview, right? I wanted to make sure that it was clear to you that this would be broadcast and that you felt comfortable with that. Why did you want to do this interview? And not just you, but I know you've brought a lot of members of the crew here. Why is this something that's important to all of you?
I didn't, to be honest, I wasn't too excited myself. I was excited, but I wasn't. It was not my decision alone, because it doesn't only pertain to me. It pertains, we're talking about a group that I represent, but it's not only my group, we represent together. So I shared this with them, and they were thrilled, and we had a discussion for an hour or two. And I feel we have a very unique scenario. We gather every morning, we talk about safety, we talk about the chores of the day, the project, and at the end of the day, we report back in the same spot where we gather, and we talk about these things, we talk about work, and we talk about our lives, and we spend so much time together before work and after work. And now we have taken it to a different level, that now we're spending time on weekends. We try not to work on Saturdays or Sundays. We end up working most Saturdays.
You mentioned that some of MexCon's employees felt in their previous jobs for other businesses as though they were being exploited. I wonder two things. First, what was that exploitation? Was that, you know, very long hours without getting overtime? And second, did they feel like that exploitation was connected in any way to the fact that they were undocumented, or was it just part of the construction trade?
Well, I witnessed some of these cases, and I witnessed a number of times having someone yell at my coworkers in front of me.
Yeah, you said yell at?
Yell at them, harsh, and being kicked out of the jobs. Not one, not two, but more than two or three of my coworkers. And that really hurt me. No one deserves to be treated or be yelled at. So here they have the freedom to say, let's go to this interview. You can see there is a handful of us, but there is many more of us out there also working, and no one's yelling at them. And that's something that goes up against my principles.
The folks from the other construction company who yelled at some of the workers who now work for MexCon, what did they say? When you mentioned that you witnessed them yelling, for example, what were they saying?
The owner came and he was walking the job. There was something went wrong, the miswiring. We were doing some electrical work. It ended up creating more work, but he started yelling at him, harsh comments, names, and I told my coworkers, guys, pick up your tools, we're leaving right now. And we left the job that day, and that day we went to work for ourselves, started working for ourselves, because I couldn't take the pressure. We were working really hard, and the owner came by and started yelling at us, stressed out, and we said, this is it, we quit. I love these guys. They're my family, and I didn't have any family here, and I still don't have any family here in the community. So we sort of became my family. So I wanted to be working with them, and it doesn't pay much, but I really enjoy working with them.
Tell me just briefly about yourself. You mentioned you don't have family here. Just tell me where you grew up, and if as a child this was your goal to work in construction in South Philadelphia for a company that you help own.
I grew up in Mexico, and I came across the border like every one of my coworkers, undocumented. So that's a connection we have. It helps us understand each other, the struggles of coming to the States. Coworkers are paying $8,000 to bring a family member across the border. So that's something that is also we encounter every now and then.
Paying coyotes.
Coyotes. But I was fortunate enough that years ago I was able to, through marriage, I got my papers. We operate like any other company. We have insurance, workers' compensation, all the licenses, and we're taking jobs from small jobs and big jobs. We've been doing work in Center City for some bigger clients. So, and that's something we're able to do because I was able, having the papers, I was able to apply for a license, get a bank account, and get insurance, and get all the legal logistics of operating a business.
And you said you came 18 years ago?
Yeah. I always worked construction since I grew up in a rural community outside of Mexico City, near Hidalgo, the state of Hidalgo. Mm-hmm. And we grew up working construction. So when I came to the States, that's the only thing I knew how to do. So I ended up working construction.
And so you said when you get done with the day at 4 or 5, you all gather and...
Gather in the same spot. We drink a beer or two, sometimes more than two. And everybody goes home and we meet up in the morning.
And after a day's work or on the days off when you go to the park, do you guys ever talk about your lives or how you came here? Does that come up? You mentioned that it helps you to connect with some of the other men. The fact that while you are here legally, you have the paperwork now, you didn't always. And so your experience was similar.
It comes up all the time. And it's heartbreaking for me. It's another connection. It's another commitment I feel I have. I feel I'm very fortunate to be able to go. I don't like to share that because they wish they could say the same thing.
You mean you're fortunate to be here legally?
I can travel to back and forth to Mexico, but most of them haven't been home for 10 years. And they haven't seen the children for 10, 15 years, or their wives. And that's another big issue here for us. We're a very isolated group. And that's when I was telling you about the mask, is we're sort of living under the shuttle. We're under the radar. We head to work, from work home, from work to home. We hardly ever go out, spend so much time together. It breaks my heart that they haven't seen their children for so long. I encourage them to go, but who am I to say how they're going to feed their families in Mexico?
You encourage them to go back.
To go back to their families.
To see their families.
Yeah, to go and stay with their children. I can only imagine it's rough. I don't have any children. So, for example, one of my closest friends and closest member here, his mother died, his father died, and he wasn't able to be with the family when that happened. And he's very quiet, very to himself, and I couldn't figure out what was happening that with my friend. I felt so bad telling him I'm going to go see my mother, and I was very excited. But when he told me my mother just died, I was speechless. I didn't know what to say.
Absolutely, and it sounds like that must have been a really difficult moment. You were probably quite excited to be traveling back to Mexico to visit your mother, and here you were sort of speaking in an excited way to your friend about that, not realizing that his mother had just passed away and he was undocumented, so could not even go back to see her or for her funeral.
Scenarios like that happen every so often. But I couldn't really speak for that because I'm not in the same position they are. Like as far as being able to express myself or travel or do the legal, what the Americans do.
And I just have one more question for you, slightly different. I wonder if you followed the presidential race at all and what you... I don't know if that's something that you all talk about, in particular Donald Trump's comments about building a wall and some of the comments that he's made about immigrants and specifically about people coming here.
I mean, I feel like I would be wasting my time. I don't like politics myself. I had just gotten my citizenship when Obama, the first time he was elected. And I went around knocking on people's doors all excited. And I went around the second time knocking on people's doors to get vote for Obama, all excited. But so many people I know had been deported. And I feel like while Obama's been in office, more people had been deported than I had heard from other presidents. So it kind of took my faith away. Now we get Trump, which I think is much more a comedian that could have a huge impact on our lives. I believe in Home Depot, and I often heard names. Derogatory names about Mexicans. I'm sort of a paranoid now because I'd be standing in the line and I heard, well, these Mexicans are here taking our jobs. I saw a guy over in Oregon, Broughton, Oregon, with a sign, with a clipboard, going around collecting signatures so they can vote for Trump. And he said, we want to take our jobs back because they're here taking our jobs.
When you hear people say things like you're in line at Home Depot and someone says the Mexicans are taking our jobs, do you stay quiet? Do you speak up? Do you turn around and look them right in the eyes? What do you do?
Well, I hesitate. I'm afraid because I don't want to get into a fist fight with someone. It makes me angry. So once I'm angry, I feel like I better walk away because it has happened a couple of times that we're driving along and they start shouting names. You know, it makes me want to get out of the truck and go talk to them and say, hey, let's take a spin.
Like when you're with your crew and you're leaving
Home Depot, and
people yell things at you.
It had happened a couple of times. But we either get beat up or go to jail. And neither one of those things sound too appealing.
Javier Garcia Hernandez, thank you so much for joining me. And thanks for bringing in the MexCon crew.
Thank you.
That's Liz Fiedler talking with Javier Garcia Hernandez about his company, MexCon. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes for more information about the program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, Liz Fiedler, and Trine Nuri are the producers of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.